Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic podcast. As Parliament heads into recess, politics isn't stopping. Graham Stewart and David Scullion discuss what we can expect in the coming weeks, from Brexit talks and the renewal of coronavirus legislation to the Lib Dem leadership election and who's likely to be fired in a coming reshuffle.
Well, Parliament is in recess. Whether or not they'll be going to Spain, politicians are packing away their shorts, their trunks, their buckets and spades for what some of them at least will regard as a brief well-earned rest before returning to Westminster in September. But what a first half of the year it has been. To discuss what Parliament and politics has involved in the first half of this year and what's going to happen, what's going to brew over the recess, I'm joined by my Critic colleague, David Scullion. David, it's fair to say that the first half of this year has been obviously and inevitably dominated by coronavirus, and the big parliamentary event of that was the passage in March of the Coronavirus Act. It gave British government the most sweeping curtailment of civil liberties in this country, really, in peacetime, since almost anyone can remember. Now, the new law has a sunset clause in 2 years' time, but for an amendment, it has to be renewed by Parliament every 6 months. So in September, when Parliament returns, MPs will have a chance to vote on renewing the measures. Do you think over the recess, politicians will be taking the temperature and deciding whether to challenge the Act, or whether actually they're quite happy to go along? And on this most massive of issues, this is the one issue where we can't expect a major backbench rebellion.
Well, I think as they go home, they are going to have to live with what the government have introduced. And it's interesting that one of the things, one of the points that was made when Jacob Rees-Mogg was getting MPs to vote socially distanced voting, where they had the huge conga around the Houses of Westminster and outside as well. One of the points somebody made was, well, they probably should keep this because they're forcing MPs to experience what the rest of the country are going through. And as MPs go back into their constituencies and see the impact of things like mask wearing in shops and have to do it themselves and see the impact that has on the high street. We don't know totally what impact that's having yet and whether that will inspire confidence or do the opposite, that they'll actually have to deal with it themselves, which I think probably is quite a good thing and could switch them more towards being against some of these more draconian measures.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm interested in what kind of mailbags MPs are getting. It does seem to me that the more libertarian response seems to have permeated the, as it were, the liberal right of the Conservative Party, but not the Lib Dems or the Labour Party. And so if there's going to be any kind of rebellion, it's going to come on Tory backbenches and not elsewhere. But, I mean, is there going to be a backbench rebellion of any size? I mean, Steve Baker is one of the MPs who voted in March for the measure, but did so, making clear he hated doing so, and is clearly very uncomfortable with much of it. I mean, if there's only going to be one or two MPs having lonely rebellions, that then clearly the Coronavirus Act is going to be renewed for a very long time to come.
Yes, I don't foresee any kind of rebellion on this or any, at least any successful rebellion. What Steve Baker and what the European Research Group tapped into was just a wide, pretty solidly angry response of Brexit voters in the country, and I don't think they can tap into the same kind of thing. Everything seems to be tinged with, safety first mentality. Why not? Why are you trying to kill your granny by not wearing a mask? I think it would be a lot harder to get that level of support that they did during Theresa May's tenure. So I don't see a rebellion coming.
No, I don't. I mean, one of the interesting things is the role of the Liberal Democrats. And that may sound surprising. People may have forgotten there is still a Liberal Democrat Party, but there is. And indeed, in August, next month, 27th of August, there will be the results of their leadership election announced between the current acting leader, Ed Davey, and Leila Moran. Have the Lib Dems missed a trick, do you think, in terms of not positioning themselves as the libertarian party of more personal freedom and personal responsibility in the same way that the Swedish Social Democrat and Green coalition in Stockholm has done? Or actually, would that be so against their desire to support the public sector in every way possible? It just, the opportunity doesn't really present itself.
I think the opposition parties in Britain seem to be split. There seems to be, after Corbyn has gone, there seems to be now a split between the kind of woke opposition and the kind of more rational, sensible, pragmatic opposition. And I think the Lib Dems seem to be firmly in the first category of woke, and that seems to chime well with their voter base. I can't see them pivoting so far towards a kind of libertarian side. It seems to have been... I imagine it will be so far from their voter base that it just won't work. And I can't imagine any of them. I mean, who's it? Leila Moran and Ed Davey. I can't see them going in that direction after the Lib Dems have been so woke.
No, I mean, I think if the Lib Dems want to play the wild card, then perhaps electing Leila Moran is a more sensible prospect. And you know, it's not what most of the season watchers of the Lib Dems are expecting. They're expecting Ed Davey to win, but Steady Eddie is such a safe choice. It's hard to discern where he is different from Keir Starmer on so many clear issues. I sometimes think Leila Moran could take a leaf out of Nigel Farage. I mean, not someone she would perhaps choose to, but reposition the Lib Dems. If it's too much to ask as a libertarian party, that then at least as a woke troublemaking party, is there an opportunity for that there, or really is Labour the only party in town there? And if so, I'm unclear whether we could describe Keir Starmer as woke or not, and perhaps that's part of his political genius.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think realistically, the only unique selling point the Lib Dems could go down is going towards the kind of AOC from the States, that kind of woke agenda. I don't see them out-keering Keir Starmer. I agree with you on that.
So, I mean, in essence, we're saying that the Lib Dems are probably going to continue to be pretty marginal to British politics for some time to come, whoever emerges as their a leader in August, and really the libertarian position, or perhaps I would say more accurately the classical liberal position, is going to be a segment within the Conservative Party. I'm wondering whether that segment is going to manifest itself in the cabinet, though, as distinct from the backbenchers. When, David, you look at the cabinet, who do you see as someone who has a perhaps a non-consensual mind? Doesn't have to be necessarily be a classical liberal, but someone who is generating slightly alternative views and stimulating debate within the cabinet.
Well, I think everybody, I think if you'd asked me this a few weeks ago, I would have said Priti Patel. I think she was the great hope of the anti-woke agenda. She was seen as a Thatcherite. She's been known to be pro-hanging before, and very, very much a small-C conservative. And there was a video going around on Twitter of her statement after the Windrush scandal, of her saying how she was dismayed that there were so many white people in her meetings everywhere she was. She was the only brown person there. She didn't add that she was the most powerful person in the room. But this has really dampened her credentials amongst kind of red meat Brexiteers, small C conservatives. So I think probably now you'd have to look at someone, I think you'd probably say a Spartan, somebody who voted against Theresa May's Brexit deal every time, probably somebody more like Suella Braverman. And she doesn't have a high public profile, being the Attorney General, she's not technically in the cabinet, and she has a slightly detached role from the cabinet because of her office. But I think you'd say somebody like her does have more of those alternative viewpoints, has been a Brexit minister. Who would you say, Graham?
Well, I think Suella Braverman is probably a very good bet. I don't see anyone in the front rank of the cabinet assuming that mantle. Michael Gove is a very interesting figure, as always. Not only the normal duties you would expect him to have at the cabinet office, but he's become the Mr. Fix-It of this government, whether things are being fixed or not. That's his role. Absolutely front line role for him in the Brexit negotiations, which will carry on during this period of recess, with an expectation that if there's going to be a deal, there'll be one in September or at the latest October. But he's also charged with many other things, the plumbing of government, and also increasingly saving the union from Westminster, since it seems to be beyond the ability of the Scottish Conservatives to do it from Holyrood. He is someone of very wide-ranging gifts and intellect, but also someone who colleagues and rivals have difficulty pinning down. They're never quite sure what he's going to do. Many Brexiteers are not entirely sure that he's on side, despite his very prominent role in the Vote Leave campaign during the referendum, and are wondering what role is really going to be played with the Northern Ireland Protocol, which potentially sabotages a lot of what a Brexit settlement could involve. I think beyond the cabinet, I mean, there are some interesting players. Ian Duncan Smith, along with Bob Seeley, really emerged at the forefront on the Huawei issue and more broadly a sceptical approach to China. This sceptical approach to China is fast becoming British foreign policy. Finally, Britain has got a foreign policy, something that we've had difficulty discerning for the last 20 years. And in that, they're joined, of course, by Tom Tugendhat, who comes from a different place in the Conservative Party than Ian Duncan Smith, but nevertheless brings a considerable authority in the Foreign Affairs Committee. So, I mean, there are a number of very interesting players at work. I think as cabinet ministers and potential cabinet ministers go away for their summer recess, which ones do you think, David, will be going away with a sense that normal business will resume for them in September, and which might be thinking that there will be a cabinet reshuffle of some kind in the autumn? I'm in danger.
Well, I think Grant Shapps has to be named in this. He is the transport minister that found himself in Spain as rules were changed on quarantine, meaning that he is now having to come back early to try and get the quarantine out of the way and actually get back to work. It's just, who knows whose fault it was, but he's got the same kind of air that Chris Grayling had, who dominated the headlines as transport minister for being, rightly or wrongly, a hapless minister who was bungling HS2 and transport across the whole of the north of England. So I can't see Grant Shapps surviving for very much longer after the next reshuffle. Who do you think we should be watching, Graham? Who do you think?
I mean, we should very obviously be watching Robert Jenrick, who has still so many questions to answer over the West Ferry Works development, and I think is looking very vulnerable. Priti Patel, the report into alleged bullying from her has still, that report has still yet to be published. We'll see if there's anything damaging in that or not. But I sense she continues to enjoy the Prime Minister's confidence. And if you remember earlier in the session, there was that extraordinary succession of Labour MPs, various people of colour who took Priti Patel to task for talking about her own experience of racism, because they argued that you know, their understanding of racism was so much better. I felt that extraordinary assault on her was utterly counterproductive, and you know, if any Conservative Prime Minister is going to stick by a Home Secretary in those kind of circumstances, I mean, surely that kind of intervention was almost designed to bring out Boris Johnson's more protective side. Do you sense that on Brexit there is I mean, is there room for rebellion there? Let's for a minute assume two scenarios. One that in the autumn the talks break down irretrievably, and there is, I mean, the term no deal isn't quite correct, but it's popularly understood, and that we'll be trading on WTO terms from the beginning of next year. How do you see that playing in Parliament? And secondly, the alternative, which is there is a deal, but it's a deal which is much closer to Michel Barnier's position, which is to say it involves a lot of conformity on regulation and some system for a fisheries policy which is closer to the common fisheries policy than it is to allowing us to have full control and decision making over our own territorial waters. So closer to that position than the government's position as laid out by their chief negotiator David Frost.
I think when the Brexiteer MPs were rebelling in Theresa May's government, they were drawing on a huge amount of support from the rest of the country, who saw Theresa May as the death of Brexit, leading us into Brexit in name only. And MPs like Steve Baker, who have a Remain heavy constituency, was drawing very heavily on that because he's lost vote share in the last few elections. This time, people have Brexiteers and people who are really exercised by this, who comment below the line in newspaper articles and on Twitter, a lot of them fully support Boris. Now that's slightly decreased, but generally they think he's on their side. Generally, they, any kind of pessimistic take on it, saying that he's trying to sell us out, they generally respond pretty angrily. I just don't see, with an 80 strong majority and with people generally supporting Boris Johnson, there's going to be a rebellion. That's not to say Boris Johnson won't sell us out. He's essentially got Theresa May's deal and it seems full steam ahead with the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is going to split Northern Ireland off from the rest of the UK and could potentially keep the whole of the UK subject to state aid rules, which would basically mean the European Court of Justice would rule over it. So that's not to say he's not selling out Brexit, but I think the public perception is so far from the idea he's selling out Brexit that had gradually developed with Theresa May, that it would be very hard for these MPs to put up much of a fight, and certainly not to get the kind of numbers that they'd need. They'd need 40 MPs to mount any kind of successful rebellion. So I just don't see it. What's your take on the issue, Graham?
Well, I think that the question is, if he wanted to, Boris Johnson could achieve what Theresa May didn't achieve and push through an Ollie Robbins style deal. The question is, does he want to do that? I don't think he ideally wants to do that. I mean, if he did, he would have stayed as Theresa May's foreign secretary. Theresa May would either still be prime minister or would have lost a general election to Jeremy Corbyn in our counterfactual world. It really depends whether the prime minister can be persuaded that a deal, any kind of deal, is better than trading on WTO terms. And if he's open to that persuasion, he's very good at not showing it in public.
I suppose it partly depends on whether he's paying attention, because Michael Gove, the man who seems to be the highest ranking politician apart from Boris Johnson involved in Brexit, he's involved in no deal planning. He said even when Boris Johnson became prime minister that he'd still be happy to vote for Theresa May's deal. So you've in Michael Gove, you've not got the same kind of person seeking this, the kind of Brexit that Brexiteers expect to be, which is to be totally free from European Court of Justice rules. You won't get the same thing that happened when Dominic Raab was foreign secretary and he had to jet off to Brussels at a moment's notice to stop Ollie Robbins signing a deal. So I think there's a point of concern there. Boris Johnson seemed to be someone who at City Hall when he was Mayor of London is just to let people get on with it and be a good delegator. Now, since he's delegated to Michael Gove, I think there's a real danger there that things will happen without him even being aware of it.
Well, I mean, there's a question of Michael Gove, which was the real Michael Gove, the Michael Gove who was happy to vote for Theresa May's deal, or the Michael Gove who's secretly relieved that didn't happen, but doesn't feel he can then, having said he would have voted for Theresa May's deal, now admit that, you know, that the whole deal had been absurd. We will find out shortly. We will also, of course, Michael Gove is an MP very focused on maintaining the union. He is a Conservative and Unionist, not just in the Scottish perspective, but also with Northern Ireland and the protocol in House of Lords committee evidence. Michael Gove said he was very much open to renegotiating the Northern Ireland protocol. However, we've seen no evidence that protocol is being renegotiated or even that there's any effort to do so. And that protocol is obviously going to be absolutely central to the push-pull that is coming as to whether to agree a deal or not. I want to end moving away from the government and crossing to the other side of the floor to the opposition. For many people, the star of the show these last few months has been the new leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer. If he's done anything, he has asserted his authority as leader of the Labour Party. Momentum, which seemed to be the maker and breaker of leaders until the end of last year, is licking its wounds at the moment. We'll see to what extent it can fight back. But I thought a real moment was Starmer's sacking of Rebecca Long-Bailey after she liked a tweet by the actress Maxine Peake. It was a tweet transgression, but one that one suspects the Labour leader could have tolerated if he'd really wanted to keep her. And now, of course, with the attempt to settle in court on Panorama and other payments, it's very clear that Keir Starmer wants to draw a line under the whole anti-Semitism debate. He's you have to hand it to him, he is taking control of his party. What can he do with that power?
Well, I think one of the most recent opinion polls showed that Keir Starmer had a higher popularity rating, far higher than the Labour Party in general. He's still got, I think it's almost a quarter of MPs are Corbynistas that were elected under the last regime. So I don't see how he can have full control over his party. There's still a a big remnant, a greater proportion of MPs now are far left. But in terms of just exercising control over his party, sure, he did a good job and he showed a lot of confidence. But it's whether or not he can be a kind of opposition leader that can get himself into number 10. If you look at the kind of rhetoric that people on the left, like in America, Barack Obama and Tony Blair in 97, their rhetoric is so different from Keir Starmer's managerial, lawyerly rhetoric. It's very hard for him to articulate what he actually believes. And it's also even harder in the current climate that we're in, where any kind of language of inclusiveness, where you talk about the country as a whole, is interpreted by a section and will be interpreted by a section of his MPs as a terrible thing to have said. If you look at Barack Obama's one of Barack Obama's very early speeches that enabled him to become a senator, he was talking about the fact that there's no black America, there's no white America, there's just the United States of America. You can't say that kind of thing anymore because the identity politics, the Black Lives Matters movement and the wokery has stopped you being able to get away with saying that kind of thing anymore on the left. So I think you'll find it very hard to get very far without using soaring rhetoric that you'd have seen before in the past.
Well, we look at the opinion polling at the moment, and the Conservatives still have quite a good lead, depending on which poll you look at, somewhere between 6% and 10%. That's obviously down from their high point at the in the middle of March, but it's only a little down from the general election, and it's really still very good figures compared to anything Theresa May could have hoped for. It seems to me that the government is still in quite a secure position, despite everything that's happened in recent months, but that there is so much to come when Parliament returns in September, the denouement on Brexit, particularly the end of the furlough scheme and potentially mass unemployment to follow. That is a debate to be picked up in the autumn. But for now, David, enjoy the summer recess, and we'll be back to discuss more politics soon.
Thanks. Good to talk to you.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.